This program is a production of the Reformed Forum, an organization devoted to producing and distributing Reformed theological content for a connected age. Online at reformedforum.org. This is Christ the Center, episode number 266. Today we speak with Paul Helseth about Old Princeton and Right Reason. Welcome to Christ the Center, Doctrine for Life, your weekly conversation of Reformed theology. This is episode number 266. My name is Camden Busey. I'm here in Wheaton, Illinois, recording on another cold day. Let me introduce to you our panel. We have Jared Oliphant, who is regional coordinator for Westminster Theological Seminary. He's working out of Charlotte, North Carolina. Welcome back, Jared. It's great to have you on again.
Thanks. Good to be on with you guys.
And we are very pleased to welcome to the program once again David Filson, who is teaching pastor at Christ Covenant PCA in Nashville, Tennessee. Welcome, David. It's good to have you.
Good to be here. Hello.
David's a regular on our program East of Eden, which addresses the biblical and systematic theology of Jonathan Edwards. A lot of great material there. I always appreciate when new episodes of that come out so I can listen and hear more about Edwards, and we appreciate David's insights there. David's also a PhD candidate. Candidate, right, David? It's good to
That's
be a
right.
candidate.
It is. You understand that, don't you?
I do. PhD candidate at Westminster Theological Seminary. You can also find him online at teachinglikerain.wordpress.com. Jared, I forgot to mention, what's the address of your blog? You post once in a while. Good stuff.
Oh, yeah, thanks. It's butinthesellastdays.com.
Yeah. That's right. And of course, you can find more of their writing and episodes at reformedforum.org. We're very blessed and pleased to welcome to the program for the very first time Dr. Paul Helseth, who is professor of Christian thought at Northwestern College in St. Paul, Minnesota. Welcome to the program, Dr. Helseth. It's great to have you on.
Thanks for having me. I'm happy to be here.
Yeah, well, we've been reading your academic writing, your articles and books for quite some time. And as I mentioned before we actually started recording, we've been meaning to have you on and interview you and talk about a number of great subjects with you, but it just hasn't happened. So we finally got around to it, and it's been long overdue, but we are pleased and very blessed today to have you and to open up on the subject of Old Princeton and Right Reason, a subject that I'm sure many of our listeners are at least aware of, and a subject that many of our listeners are no doubt going to be more and more interested in as we unpack it. But before we do open up into this subject, I do need to mention that Christ the Center is listener-supported, and we would encourage you to visit us online at reformedforum.org/donate today so that you can partner with us, help us to continue our work here of providing Christians with solid resources in Reformed theology, resources that can help and bolster, hopefully, encourage you in your faith. We want to support the church in any way that we can, and we would encourage you to partner with us if you're able to help us to do that. Visit us online again at reformedforum.org/donate. We thank you so much for all of your support of Reformed Forum and this particular program, Christ the Center. Well, when I got the latest issue of the Confessional Presbyterian Journal here, it's now up to Volume 8, the 2012 edition. Always a handsome title, and they devoted a number of articles here to the 200th anniversary of Princeton Theological Seminary. Of course, it was founded in 1812, and I'd encourage anybody to pick up a copy of David Calhoun's, basically, it's a history of Princeton Seminary, a biography of sorts, and has a lot of helpful information in there. And talks about a number of the people that were involved, and we look back to Old Princeton as just a shining example of Reformed thought, especially in America, a high watermark in some regards. And we have a great number of conceptions and a great number of thoughts about the theologians there, the old Princetonians. But what we have in front of us here today is some new scholarship that might call into question some of the conceptions that you have, or some of the thoughts that our listeners might have about what was going on at Old Princeton and how their influences went about shaping and guiding their thought. Dr. Helseth, you say in this article in the Confessional Presbyterian Journal here, the title of it, Right Reason and the Science of Theology at Old Princeton Seminary, Companion piece in many ways to your book, Right Reason and the Princeton Mind, an Unorthodox Proposal from PNR. But at least in the Confessional Presbyterian, you write that Princeton theologians' insistence upon the objective nature of religious truth, their endorsement of an inductive approach to the interpretation of Scripture, their spirited advocacy of the doctrine of inerrancy, and their commitment to an evidentialist approach to both the defense and the advancement of the faith were all grounded, many of their critics contend, not in faithfulness to the assumptions of the Reformed tradition, but in an implicit and an even times even explicit commitment to precisely that kind of Enlightenment philosophy that is largely responsible for the decline and fall of Calvinism as the dominant force in the American church. So you're calling into question, rightly here, perhaps, some of the influences of these old Princetonians. Just in order to set the tone for our interview, can you provide for us some of the conventional wisdom, as it were, or some of the common criticisms that you find of figures like Charles Hodge and B.B. Warfield and the role of that reason plays in their theological endeavor?
Well, I think the concise way to summarize the standard critique is to understand that the late 18th and 19th centuries, and in many respects much of contemporary evangelicalism, seems to be dominated or have been dominated by Scottish common sense realism, which is a philosophers say is a kind of a moderate form of Enlightenment philosophy that really doesn't line up terribly well with many of the foundational assumptions of Reformed theology and biblical teaching. And I think that with that in mind, the standard critique of old Princeton suggests that their emphasis on objective truth, their emphasis on the logical priority of the intellect in faith, the critique is that their intellectualism was grounded in a kind of either explicit or more often than not implicit accommodation of the prevailing mindset of the 19th century. And that mindset was informed largely by Scottish common sense realism. So as John Stuart has argued, it was Scottish common sense realism was the lingua franca of the 19th century. It was kind of in the water, it was in the air, and it really dominated the life of the mind in many respects. And it was problematic because it, in some respects, had an overblown assessment of human rational and moral ability. So the critique of old Princeton is that they didn't take the noetic effects of sin as seriously as they should have. They were overly optimistic about the power of evidence, kind of more to the point of what the article we're looking at and my book are about is the idea that their understanding of right reason was grounded more in a rejection of Reformed distinctives than in an endorsement of Reformed distinctives. So Cornelius Van Til, for example, critiques old Princeton and Warfield in particular for Warfield's emphasis on right reason, which, according to Dr. Van Til, was an emphasis on the natural man's right reason. So the unregenerate have the ability to reason rightly, and that I think we would agree would be difficult to reconcile with Reformed distinctives. So that's it in a nutshell. I think, and then it kind of I don't know, it blossoms out from there, so to speak, particularly in criticism that comes from non-Reformed scholars. So the prevailing take on Old Princeton in the academy is that their commitment to the doctrine of inerrancy, their emphasis on an inductive theological method,
right,
their commitment to systematic theology and theological propositions, all of those are in one way or another grounded in this intellectualism, which, again, the standard assessment says is itself grounded in Enlightenment philosophy, namely Scottish common sense realism. So I think that's in a nutshell.
That's useful, and it's important to set that foundation as we hopefully will move on to unpack that. But just to see how evangelicals and just critics at broad in the wider academy have criticized Princeton, but also to see how the Reformed have criticized some aspects of figures like Warfield and Hodge is quite helpful, because that sets up what we're going to question here with regard to right reason. Now, you've devoted much time and effort to the study of Old Princeton, and particularly this subject, the right reason. How did you end up on this academic path, and what brought you to challenge some of the conventional critiques on the subject?
Well, actually, I became interested in Old Princeton when I was working on my PhD at Marquette University. Mm-hmm. I didn't grow up in the Reformed camp. I grew up in a more of a liberal Lutheran context, and slowly migrated into evangelicalism. And when I got to graduate school, having had little to no exposure to Reformed theology, I had the opportunity to read in my American Church History class Machen's book, Christianity and Liberalism. And I was reading that book at the same time that I was taking a course with the title, The Structure of Religious Experience, in which we were reading every week a book by a post-Kantian theologian. And I discovered and found that Machen's book was addressing, in a very, very contemporary and very, very relevant way, exactly the thing that I was encountering in my reading for this course on religious experience. And that got me interested in Machen and the school of thought that Machen was associated with. And as I got more into reading Machen and the Old Princetonians, it became clear to me that the way their way of doing theology and thinking about theology, the way that was being discounted and dismissed was by associating it with Scottish common sense realism. And because Scottish common sense realism's heyday has passed, the assumption was that the Old Princetonians were kind of obsolete. I mean, they were fine for fundamentalists and people who are dogmatic and not terribly fun to invite to parties and things like that. But you know, they really weren't players in the contemporary discussions because of their outmoded way of thinking. And so the more I read, and the more I thought about the reason the Princetonians were being rejected, it occurred to me that if the Princetonians were guilty of what the critics said they were guilty of, and continue to say they are guilty of, then they were not only outmoded, but they were quite incompetent, because they seemed, if the standard critique holds water, then they are guilty of compromising on some of the what seems to me are the some of the most basic assumptions of a Reformed way of thinking about theology. So that's kind of what drew me in. I was interested in defending the old Princetonians, but I was interested in defending them because I, not because I had grown up in their camp, so to speak, but because I saw merit to what they were saying, and I thought that they had a whole lot more that they could say if people would simply allow them the opportunity to speak, so to speak.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And that's quite useful and quite interesting also to think of somebody studying at Marquette, a Catholic institution, to come to be quite interested with Machen. And it's just amusing to see all the little places that Reformed people come from and where they're fostered.
Well, you know, if I might just add to that a little bit, I one of the things I really appreciated about my time at Marquette was I was very appreciative of the freedom that I was given to think about things and read things that were of interest to me.
Oh, sure.
But it became I became persuaded after not too long in the graduate program that if the kind of the prevailing way of thinking about and doing theology, namely from a post-Kantian perspective, if that is the right way to do theology, well, then I'm not sure what good it has to offer to anybody, quite frankly. So I was, the Machen and the Princetonians were, in a sense, kind of, life ring, so to speak, that was thrown to me in the water that kind of helped me navigate my way through graduate school and come out being more persuaded than I went in the truthfulness of the Christian worldview and the rightness of a conservative approach to thinking about theology. So I'm quite grateful to the Lord's for His providence in kind of bringing me to the right. Reformed camp, and by after me my family through the Princetonians. So I feel a kind of kinship with them, even though I'm still regard myself as very much a novice in terms of Reformed theology. So.
It's interesting. I've had some interactions with the folks at Marquette and found them to be very pleasant, very capable too. A friend of mine in my presbytery has just graduated there, and I was hoping on the prospect of studying with a fellow there too to study Karl Rahner. But also at schools like Marquette and even the Catholic University of America, it's interesting if you mention Reformed and people suddenly assume that you're speaking about Karl Barth.
Yes.
But that's pretty far from what we're finding in old Princeton here, that's for sure.
Right.
You've mentioned Scottish Common Sense Realism. I think it would be useful for many of our listeners, although a number of them will be familiar with what you mean, but perhaps you can describe some features of Scottish Common Sense Realism and explain for us some of the big figures and who is typically understood to be the big influence upon figures like Hodge and Warfield.
Well, I think when it comes to Scottish Common Sense Realism, a number of Scottish Enlightenment figures are appealed to, and I think the two that seem to be most significant for the American context are Francis Hutcheson and Thomas Reed. Francis Hutcheson's moral philosophy is relevant to the kind of Republican politics that came to dominate at the time of the American Revolution and seemed to take hold in America after the Revolution and throughout at least the beginning of our nation's history. And that was kind of, again, the standard storyline is that that emphasis on the moral sentiment, a kind of from Francis Hutcheson and other Scottish thinkers was adopted at places like Princeton and Harvard and a number of educational institutions in early modern America, and that a Scottish moral philosophy was disseminated through American educational institutions and really took hold in the American context in the 19th century. And the idea then is that Thomas Reed's epistemology, in a sense, followed the moral philosophy of Hutcheson. The person who's done the most work on Scottish common sense realism in the American context, or one of the people who's done the most work on it, is Mark Knoll.
Oh, yes.
And it's very, very helpful and very, very good, and as one would expect. But he talks about three ways that Scottish common sense realism impacted America, not just in terms of theology, but in terms of politics and everything else. He talks about an ethical common sense, an epistemological common sense, and a methodological common sense. And I, in my article, I have an excerpt from a treatment of this topic by Knoll. And it's an attempt to summarize the relevance of common sense. So when he speaks about, he refers to an ethical common sense, which is the idea that we have this kind of intuitive knowledge about foundational principles of morality. And the idea was that, you know, in order for the Republic to function, even people who aren't associated with any religious group have to have the wherewithal to act and live morally. So Scottish common sense realism was very helpful in kind of generating that consciousness. The second form of common sense realism that was influential was an epistemological common sense. And I think this is more relevant to the work that I've been doing on Old Princeton and that others are doing on Old Princeton. And at its heart is the idea that human beings have the natural ability to know reality as it is. I think that's how I would put it. So this is where I think people start to question whether this emphasis on kind of the basic human ability to know reality as it is, if this is compatible with a reformed emphasis on the noetic effects of sin. And I think there are some legitimate questions associated with that. And then the third way that Scottish common sense realism is relevant to theology in the 19th century and in many respects into the 20th century is in terms of method. And here's where a kind of Baconian inductivism becomes relevant to the discussion. So how did Scottish common sense realism lead people to handle the Bible, for example? Well, in terms of a kind of inductive study of what the text says. So one of the common places where people are critical of the old Princetonians is in terms of Hodge's discussion of the inductive theological method in the opening pages of the first volume of his Systematic Theology, where he refers to the Bible as a storehouse of facts and suggests that the work of the theologian should be focused on the facts of the text. So that emphasis is taken by most interpreters to be an indication of just one more place where Scottish common sense realism had a negative impact on Old Princeton. And one more thing that's relevant, the standard narrative, historiographical narrative, is that this the impact of Scottish common sense realism was felt throughout the nation, not just at Princeton, but throughout the country and at virtually every seminary. So, as we said earlier, it really was the kind of the lingua franca of the day, and it had a distinct impact on how theologians thought about theology, how they handled the text, and how they did apologetics. So,
yeah, that's quite useful. Yeah, Noel does draw that out heavily in his book. Yeah. For if people are interested, America's God. He also has a helpful section on the Puritan canopy there, but he's very quick to point out what he sees as a heavy influence of Scottish common sense realism there.
Yeah,
I thought that was helpful, what you just said. There's a number of ways that we can go on this. I liked your connection to Enlightenment biblicism and your description of it there. I hadn't thought about that carefully before reading your article, and it was just interesting to note those two pairings, Enlightenment and biblicism, and you described theological method, and maybe we can get into that. But particularly speaking of Hodge, I also appreciated the way that you, in this first section of the article, you describe maybe how some of the standard critiques can kind of be validated, or at least parts of them. So it's kind of a yes and no answer. And you start out going, well, here are a few passages that maybe, lend itself to some of the standard critiques out there. But specifically, you note this, but Hodge appealed to human consciousness, and what he sometimes calls the universal judgment of men to confirm and sometimes establish the theological positions that he embraces. And so how are we to think of that, the universal judgment of men, in light of some of the common sense discussions that we've been having?
Interestingly, a number of church historians like Noel and Bruce Kuklick, I believe is his name. I don't know if I'm pronouncing it correctly. And a number of others make the case that in the 19th century, though this emphasis on consciousness and, in a sense, the integrity of human consciousness and the reliability of human consciousness, that emphasis came to have a significant impact on how people talked about knowing. And the idea is that understanding of the consciousness concept was grounded in Scottish common sense realism. So one of the ways that we know with certainty the nature of reality is not necessarily by appealing to some sort of external authority. It's not by going to Scripture. It's by examining the state of our consciousness. I do think that, sadly, that Hodge in particular does accommodate, or at least he certainly appears to accommodate, Scottish common sense realism from time to time when he appeals to the universal judgment of men, and he appeals to consciousness. The one example that I give in the article is in his rejection of the doctrine of concursus. And he rejects the doctrine not by appealing to the text, not by appealing to the confession, but by appealing to this universal judgment of men. We all just know that we originate our own actions. So for that reason, the doctrine of concursus can't be right. I'm kind of stating it a little bit too bluntly there, but I think that's going on, and that disturbs me. I wish he wouldn't do that. Well, how do I account for that then? Well, the way I try and account for it in the article and the way I try and account for it in just my own thinking about these things is to say that Hodge and his colleagues at Old Princeton, they were the children of their times. They did, it certainly seems, they did accommodate at times. They weren't perfectly consistent in working out their reform commitments. And to the extent that they did accommodate, and to the extent that they were inconsistent, then that's like I say, that disturbs me. I wish they wouldn't have done that.
Yeah.
But I don't know how else to account for it, because I think that on the other hand, there are clear instances that show where Hodge and his colleagues didn't accommodate. So they were critical of the Nathaniel William Taylor, for example, and the New England theologians for what they regarded as the New England theologians' accommodation of assumptions that were ultimately grounded in philosophy, not in the text or in the confession. So they weren't perfect, as far as I can tell. And so that's how I account for those things.
Paul, it seems to me that, you know, as I look at the article and especially at the book, which I love, by the way. It seems like, in some ways, the heart of this book is kind of the heart of the matter. You know, in the chapter on the bald rationalism with a question mark at the end of it, and your question, is this a bald rationalism? You talk about Warfield's use of Augustine's theistic intuitionalism and Calvin's conception of the sensus deitatis, and then later on you'll talk about Augustinian voluntarism and so forth, and you ask the question about the ethical state of the knower, the ethical state of the heart, etc. Talk a little bit about that, if you would, and how that figures into at least Warfield's conception of ontology and epistemology.
Okay. Well, I think that this... I think you're right, David, that at the heart of the book, at the heart of the article, and at the heart of my thinking about the Old Princetonians, and really at the heart of my critique of the standard critique of Old Princeton, is the idea that I'm persuaded is grounded in the primary sources. I don't think I'm reading it into the Princeton guys, but it's the idea that knowing for the Princetonians is an activity of the whole soul.
Mm-hmm.
So knowing is not just an intellectual thing. Rather, it's something that involves the heart. It's something that there's a qualitative dimension to it, and that qualitative dimension is ultimately determined by the inclination of the soul or the character of the knower, and to know rightly presupposes that there is a kind of correspondence between the knower and the thing known. So there's a great quote in one of the sermons that Hodge preached, and I'm blanking on where it is right now, but he says, "The knowledge of Christ is not the apprehension of what he is simply by the intellect, but also a due apprehension of his glory as a divine person arrayed in our nature, and involved not as its consequence merely, but as one of its elements, the corresponding feeling of adoration, delight, desire, and complacency."
Very so Edwardsian in a sense, right?
Pardon me?
Very Edwardsian in a sense.
Yes, it seems like it, and I think in his essay on regeneration and the manner of its occurrence, Hodge makes it very, very clear that this idea, this Edwardsian idea of the spiritual sense, which is, you know, generated by the work of the Spirit, is essential to knowing rightly. And so knowing rightly is not just knowing about, it's not just having, knowing a true proposition, it's knowing it and seeing it more or less for what it is. So if you know about Christ but you don't love Christ, you don't know him rightly. And I think that if there's something to that, in other words, if the way I and others are interpreting this emphasis on right reason, if that's correct, then it's difficult to see how the charge of rationalism can stick, so to speak, because knowing is an activity of the whole soul, so the feelings are necessarily involved. So to see something, to know something rightly, you see it for what it is. And, truth for the Princetonians has a kind of moral dimension to it.
Oh, sure.
So to see it, to know it rightly, you have to get that moral dimension. So I don't know, David, if that gets at what you were getting at.
Oh, but that beautifully done. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, knowledge is definitely ethical, especially when you consider that God's the omniscient one, the one who knows all things, and if anything's to be true, if we are to know it true, it's known in relationship, or as Dr. Oliphant would say, in covenant with the ultimate knower. And so that's quite interesting, and that's quite different from sometimes what they're charged with, isn't it, which is a three-substance view of the faculty of psychology. How have people understood old Princetonians holding to some sort of three-substance view?
You know, I'm not sure where they get that. I do know that Kuklick has mentioned Bruce Kuklick has said in a couple of essays that the Princetonians endorse this three-substance view of the faculty psychology. So the mind, the will, and the emotions are distinct hypostatizations, as he puts it,
uh-huh.
And others put it that actually I think it's James Hoops who refers to them as distinct hypostatizations. But the idea is that the mind and the will and the emotions are these independent faculties that can mm-hmm. operate more or less independently of one another, and that commitment is what critics insist sets the Princetonians apart from Edwards, because Edwards endorsed a more functionalist view of the soul, a more unitary view of the soul, and I look at what the Princetonians have written about the unity of the soul and the nature of knowing, I see the Princetonian standing very much in line with Edwards on how to think about the operation of the soul, given the unity of the soul.
Yeah.
And I know that Jeff Waddington has a good discussion of this in his dissertation. So that might be a fun program to have with Jeff.
Yeah, you speak about Edwards and some of those features.
Yeah.
That is quite interesting. Another thing that you mentioned related to that subject, particularly through the work of George Marsden, but before we want to get into that, I just wanted to ask quite simply about Hodge's scientific endeavors, as they were. He talks about theology as a science, or at least speaking about a theological science. How was he using that word? Because that word science in that use might confuse a number of present day theologians.
Yeah, I think the way that Hodge refers to theology as a science, particularly in the opening pages of his Systematic Theology. I think the defenders of Old Princeton, like myself, must concede that the language isn't perhaps the best language to use, because in the way that Hodge discusses the science of theology, he is essentially comparing the work of the theologian to the work of the natural scientist. So just as the natural scientist is dealing with natural facts, so too the Christian theologian is dealing with the facts of the text. And speaking like that suggests a kind of, it suggests a kind of rationalism. It suggests that the doing of theology is simply an intellectual kind of endeavor that has to do with merely arranging facts in their right order, and so it in a sense takes the spirit out of it, so to speak. I think that it's important to note that towards the end of Hodge's discussion of method in the opening pages of Volume 1 of his Systematic Theology, he makes it clear that the heart plays a central role in the doing of theology. So it's not merely the intellect analyzing a bunch of cold facts and arranging them, but rather it's a person with a renewed heart analyzing, studying God's revelation to understand it the way God would have his creatures understand it. So I suspect there's a whole lot more to say on that.
Well, sure, and you know, I was wondering, because George Marsden, you introduce his work, and he's just a well-recognized church historian, and rightly so.
Yes.
But he speaks about the scientific method for discovering truth exactly and objectively. That's kind of strong language. But he continues, he goes on to argue that Hodge and others subordinated maybe the work of the Spirit, or at least religious experience, to the hard facts of scientific theological enterprise. My question more or less relates to how we are to understand religious experience here in this theological endeavor. What is the role of the work of the Spirit, or at least the experience of the work of the Spirit in someone's life for theological pursuits? What would Hodge say to this?
Well, I think that he would say something like this, and I think that the Princetonians in general would say something like that. Maybe just to address Marsden's treatment.
Sure.
As a kind of a segue into that, I will confess feeling a bit sheepish, if that's the right word, for speaking people like George Marsden and Mark Knoll and others in this regard. I certainly recognize who they are, and I recognize who I am, so I'm a little I understand what I'm doing. But with that said, I think that, for example, in this article, the essay by Marsden that I am challenging, I think Marsden is mistaken when he suggests that for someone like Hodge, you first deal with the facts of the text and then experience kicks in. He says in the essay that you're referring to, Camden, he says that that for the Princetonians and American theologians in the 19th century generally, their main interest in Scripture was as a practical book to challenge the heart in matters of life and death. Heart-changing work of the Holy Spirit, they emphasized, complemented the objective understanding of Scripture. Now, he leaves it there. That first, and what that suggests to me is that for Marsden, what Hodge and other American theologians in the 19th century who were overly indebted to Scottish common sense realism, what they were doing was saying that, listen, first we understand objectively the facts. We understand, we do our inductive analysis of the text, we get the facts, we arrange them properly, so that's the objective work, and then we try and apply them. Then, after we've done that objective work, then religious experience and trying to see the practical implications and all of that, that's when experience kicks in. And what I want to say is, I think that the fundamental or the standard critique of Old Princeton goes wrong at that point. Because I think that given the way that the Princetonians thought about the nature of truth and about the nature of reality, I think that they would say, in order to understand objectively, you must see it for what it is. So in order to understand God's revelation objectively, you must have the capacity not just to arrange a bunch of propositions in the right way, but you have to have the ability to see the significance of those propositions. So, again, the doing of theology is not just an intellectual endeavor, it is a whole-souled endeavor, and it is a whole-souled endeavor that can be done rightly only by somebody who has eyes to see, only by somebody who has the capacity to see, only by somebody who has a regenerated heart. So you can kind of see that if I'm right in thinking about, if I and others are right in how we're thinking about the way the old Princetonians thought about the science of theology, it's not just this rational endeavor, this intellectual endeavor that's trying to deal with or arrange a bunch of cold facts, but rather it's an activity that presupposes a regenerated heart, a whole soul that is inclined to God, and that whole soul is engaging what God has revealed, both in the text and outside of the text, with the attempt to see it and understand it the way it is, and the way it just is it is declaring God's glory in some sense. So I think the way Marsden is characterizing Hodge's understanding of the task of theology, that first you do the objective work, and after that's done, so to speak, religious experience kicks in one way or another. I think that I don't think that that's an accurate portrayal of how the Princetonians thought about the science of theology.
I was going to ask, it's very much related to the fourth section you have, right reason in the normal state of man. And I think it's a good starting point to discuss what is regeneration's effect upon reason as the old Princetonians understood it. Were they explicit about this, how regeneration affects reason?
I think that what I'd say would be this, that again, that for the Princetonians, reasoning is not a function of the intellect alone. So it's not that the Holy Spirit, in making someone new, is making somebody more rational, so to speak, but rather the Spirit is taking out a heart of stone, giving a heart of flesh, reorienting, so to speak, the character of the individual so that the person now is reasoning and feeling and willing in a right way. So they have a capacity, an ability to see and to know that those who do not have the spirit, they don't have that ability. They don't have that capacity. So, I mean, again, I didn't grow up in the Reformed camp, but it seems to me that this is pretty standard Reformed fare, but it's precisely the kind of thing that the standard critique of Old Princeton suggests is missing from their theology, and I just don't see it.
It's one thing, Cornelius Van Til is often considered to be the bridge between Kuyper and Warfield, apologetically speaking. Kuyper is very strong on the antithesis, so he recognizes the effects of, or the noetic effects of sin, but he does so so heavily that there's really no practical value in apologetics, at least for the unbeliever. Warfield, on the other hand, is very strong on emphasizing the objectivity of revelation and the ability of that revelation to have a meaningful impact and influence upon the unbeliever, but the critics at least have suggested that he also lets in the door at least some measure of autonomy in terms of his reason and understanding of reason. Would you correct this assessment of Van Til's role as a bridge between the two? How would you understand, correct, address that particular assessment of B.B. Warfield and his apologetic?
And Camden, when you referred to the bridge, could you just remind me the bridge between what and what?
Oh, yes. I'm sorry. Many people have understood Cornelius Van Til and his apologetic insights being the bridge between those two figures.
Okay.
Because it, particularly yes. through his understanding of the point of contact being the yes. image of God and also his doctrine of common grace. So he bridges the gap between, quite simplistically here, Warfield's commonality between believer and unbeliever and Kuyper's giant chasm between the two.
I think, and I deal with this in the book a little bit, and I deal with it in this article even less, but it's there in some way. I don't think that Warfield thought that the regenerate and the unregenerate look at and assess truth in the same way. I don't think that Warfield was committed to this notion of autonomy. I realize here this is where traditionally the debate between evidentialists and presuppositionalists or covenant apologists, to use Dr. Paul's
yes.
lingo,
hot topic lately.
yes, that this is where a significant amount of disagreement is taking place. And I guess I wonder, might it be possible that there might be some talking past one another happening at this point? Because I think that Warfield and the Princetonians would say that it's possible to understand things in one sense, but not in another. And I know a few weeks ago you did one of your programs on Jonathan Edwards' sermon on Christian knowledge, and this idea that it's possible to know something in a speculative sense, but not in a spiritual sense. I think that whole discussion is relevant to the discussion we're currently having, because I think that Warfield and the Princetonians would say that although the unregenerate can reason and therefore can have some real knowledge, they cannot reason rightly. So they can't see the significance of that knowledge. They can't see truth. They can't see the moral and spiritual excellence of truth, even though they can see something. And one of the images that Hodge uses, and I believe it's in a footnote in this essay, is that a person who is not trained in music can have some understanding of what's going on when he or she listens to a piece of music, but they're missing the most important stuff. They're missing what makes the music great, because they don't have the capacity to see it. And I think that might be playing a role in these discussions, at least in I think it would be playing a role and is playing a role for the Princetonians.
It's almost similar to Van Til's psychological / epistemological distinction. He makes a similar distinction there. It's an interesting connection.
Well, you know, I would defer to you guys on that. I am by no means a competent scholar on Van Til, but every time I read Van Til as a kind of layperson when it comes to dealing with Van Til and his work, I don't see a real, you know, unsurmountable chasm between Warfield and Van Til and Vantilians, precisely because I don't see Warfield appealing to the natural man's right reason. Right reason is the regenerated man's reason, as far as I can tell. If that's the case, then there it seems to me there's maybe some significant room for further exploration.
Yeah. Yeah, that's something Jeff Waddington was talking about. He recently did a review of a book by David P. Smith I mentioned earlier, I think before the recording started, of course. But
yeah.
And he was suggesting, you know, it's time perhaps for a reassessment. Those were his thoughts. So we'd be interested to hear from the listeners, too, what you guys think on this subject. But I think with your work, we've definitely reopened the case, as it were, I think in a good way, and it's going to spur on further conversation.
Yeah, and I'm certainly open to being challenged and corrected on that, but I just see, you know, if knowing for the Princetonians is more than just an intellectual thing, it's an activity of the whole soul, and if associated with that whole soul epistemology is the awareness that we live in God's world, and God's world is declaring his glory, and to see it for what it is, you must be able to discern that glory in some sense. It seems to me that those are two pretty significant things that might suggest a real basis for some significant agreement.
I had a question on just some of the lesser known figures of old Princeton. This is kind of jumping off of your piece that you wrote, but just in your studies, the conversation reminded me of a book called Plundering the Egyptians, and starts off with an old Princeton / Westminster professor, Robert Dick Wilson. And there's a section on Scottish common sense realism and the evidential method, and the author John Yao puts Wilson kind of squarely in the evidential common sense realism camp. But that just prompted me to ask, what are there similar things going on in the biblical studies departments that we know Warfield and Hodge, they're the big names, but have you looked at other figures that are in that tradition and seen either continuity, similarities between the figures we've already mentioned?
No, I've spent most of my time looking at Hodge, Warfield, Archibald Alexander, and Machen.
Mm-hmm.
I dip into others as much as I'm able, and I'm hoping to do more of that. I'm hoping to spend more time in the archives at Princeton Seminary. But I've most of my time has been spent with the more well-known figures. So I wish I could say more about that, but I think it's best that I probably not.
It'd also be, I think, just talking out loud, interesting to try to study Voss because he didn't grow up with the American context.
Yeah.
There might be something interesting there, a comparison and contrast between old Princeton Americans and old Princeton, you know, Dutch children.
I'm certainly looking forward to, I don't read Dutch, so I'm certainly looking forward to his systematic theology coming out here, hopefully sooner rather than later, through Logos, I think.
Yeah, Dr. Gaffin is heading up that... he's the editor of that translation, so they're working hard, but it's a lot of work. So I'm looking forward to that myself. Jared, did you have another question before?
I just had a question. Is this another example of just historical method in general, looking back on certain figures and just understanding that figures in the Reformed tradition, wherever they come from, are usually not just completely consistent in their Reformed theology and methodology at every single point, and just recognizing that there is a little bit of a mixture with, I think, most of the guys that we're going to be studying through history. So that, again, I'm just kind of thinking generally here that it's safer to say something like a rationalistic tendency than labeling a guy like Hodge as just a complete rationalist. And in other words, is this kind of a call for some nuance and some, discretion when it comes to just the broad brush labels?
Well, I think it is. Again, I think that it's possible to look at some of the things that Hodge said and the other Princetonians, at least the ones I've looked at, some of the things that they've said and have plausible grounds for thinking that they were perhaps too influenced by the Scottish common sense realism of the culture that they lived in. But with that being said, I think that it's possible to overdo that and to, in a sense, dismiss them, as theologians who were such thoroughgoing children of their time that they really don't have anything useful to say to us today. And so I do think that there's a place for a kind of nuanced assessment of a school of thought like the Princeton theology. I can say that I think that I've been chastened, if that's the right word, in my attempts to try and understand the Princetonians and some of their critics. I think it's easy, particularly when dealing with undergraduates, to... in a sense, draw rigid lines, put people in a kind of a rigid box and either embrace them because they're the greatest thing since sliced bread or reject them because they're not perfect the way we think they should be perfect. I do think that there's a place for reading them in... context and reading their primary sources in light of some of the standard critiques or common prevailing assumptions about them, and reading charitably. So all of that to say, yes, I think that there's a lot of room here for a more nuanced appropriation of the Princetonians.
How do you think, Paul, that you know, more nuanced appreciation of the Princetonians, as you say, will sort of help fortify us as those who, you know, would sort of see ourselves as heirs of the Princetonians, conservative, you know, followers of the Princetonians, fortify us against a post-conservative critique, kind of a doctrinal reductionism, a doctrinal agnosticism?
Well, I think that it would help a nuanced appropriation of the old Princetonians, I think, would help us to see that they simply weren't rather bald rationalists, to use the title of one of the chapters, but they did have a significant place in their thinking for experience, for the work of the Spirit. I think they had a significant place for presuppositions. They recognized that the inclination of one's heart will have a determinative impact on how one views and assesses something. So I think that a more nuanced appropriation of the old Princetonians might show not that they're irrelevant to contemporary theological discussions that are taking place, particularly those that are taking place within contemporary evangelicalism between conservatives and post-conservatives. Rather, I think that a nuanced appropriation of them would say, or would reveal, that they are relevant to contemporary discussions, because they do acknowledge that subjective and experiential factors play a role in our knowing, but they acknowledge that without, in a sense, jettisoning the objective substance of the faith. So they have a place for experience, they have a place for subjectivity, but that the place that they give to subjectivity and experience doesn't overwhelm or neutralize, so to speak, the objective teaching of Scripture.
That's making dogmatism really unavoidable, and if properly done, necessary, right?
Yes, yeah, and Warfield has an essay on dogmatism. But it's not a kind of rigid dogmatism that's unwilling to think a new thought or learn anything new. But it's the kind of dogmatism that recognizes that, listen, there are some things that the church has established are true, and we ought not to trifle with those things. But those should become part of the established structure of our theology, and we should, in a sense, move on from there. And, you know, this Warfield's discussion of progressive orthodoxy and how that's different from what he calls retrogressive heterodoxy, that whole discussion seems to be very relevant to contemporary discussions that are taking place in evangelicalism. I think that he would say that many contemporary efforts to do theology in a progressive kind of way, they're not genuinely progressively orthodox. Rather, they are retrogressively heterodox, because they are, in a sense, abandoning the objective substance of the faith. And I know that many post-conservatives would recoil at that characterization, but I think that that's what the Princetonians would say, and I think that you know, a nuanced appropriation of the old Princetonians would show that they are relevant to these discussions.
Well, it's fantastic to reappropriate some of these things, or at least revisit this theology and these figures, and they're giants, and we appreciate them so much. But it's interesting to see another aspect of them seen in a different light. And at the end of at least the Confessional Presbyterian article, you reference Alan Strange's argument that a revolution is currently underway in the study of Old Princeton. And we appreciate your remarks today, and also the encouragement and all the prospects that we have before us for studying Old Princeton and reconsidering some of these things, all with the view of better understanding what is God's truth and how we are to go about knowing in his world and knowing him. So thanks so much, Dr. Helseth, for joining us. We really appreciate you taking the time, and we appreciate all your work, and we look forward to more coming from your pen. So thanks for joining us today.
Well, thanks so much for asking, Camden, and it was a pleasure to speak with you and Jared and David. So thanks to you all.
Well, we look forward to following up in the future, and I also want to point people to a number of different places. You can find David online, again, at teachinglikerain.wordpress.com, as well as the East of Eden program and Reformed Forum. Jared is also available, but he also, I should mention, works for Westminster, and you can find a number of things online at wts.edu. And we're online at reformedforum.org. There you'll find information about all of our programs, including East of Eden and some new projects we have spinning up even as I speak. And if you want to get a hold of us, you can email us at mail@reformedforum.org or tweet us @reformedforum. I want to thank everybody for listening. I hope you join us again next time on Christ Center.